The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're talking about bipolar disorder this month with Dr. Ann Lynn. Welcome back, Ann. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. So we wanted to talk about the treatment of bipolar disorder this month. One of the things we talked about early on is that early treatment helps. And so now we want to talk about what that treatment is. Before we get started, have you developed any conflicts of interest since we last talked?
No, I have not.
All right. Well, let's talk about treating bipolar disorder. It seems like the case for making a careful diagnosis of bipolar disorder comes down to this, and that we know the right thing to do to treat it. Is that correct?
Yes, I think so. But also, I think it can minimize impairment and family dysfunction. Bipolar disorder is harder to treat. I think that, you know, there are people who are diagnosed with bipolar disorder tend to have larger levels of dysfunction with hospitalization, suicide attempts, but more impairment as far as school, peer relations, and family relations. They also tend to end up on more medications than the typical psychiatric disorder. And so I think many people with bipolar disorder end up on multiple medications.
Well, let's talk about what medications are helpful in a bipolar disorder. What is used to treat bipolar disorder?
So for bipolar disorder in adolescents and kids, things are kind of broken down into what's used for acute mania. And so the medications that are better for acute mania treatment tend to be the second generation antipsychotics. And multiple ones have been approved for that. And that's risperidone, aripiprazole, quetiapine, olanzapine, and acenapine, which is Safris. Lithium was also approved for acute mania. And so there's the acute mania treatments, and then there's the bipolar depression treatments, which recently the Symbiax, which is olanzapine plus fluoxetine, and Latuda have been approved for that.
Is that a fixed combination medication?
So Symbiax is olanzapine fluoxetine combination medication, and gotcha. That's approved for 10 to 17-year-olds with bipolar depression. And then Latuda, which is lurasidone, was approved in also in the same age group, 10 to 17, for bipolar depression. And then for maintenance treatment, it's more lithium and Abilify. So kind of three different phases to think about.
And so are patients treated in the various phases? During the manic episode, you're treated with one thing. During a depressive episode, you're treated with another thing. Is there a baseline medication? How's that typically configured?
So I think if someone presents with mania, I think there's going to be quicker response when you use the second generation antipsychotic. And some people would just continue that same medication that people stabilized on as their maintenance medication. But when you have to think about choosing a medication, many of these antipsychotic studies were done in the short term. And so a lot of the mania studies might only be 6 weeks long. And so they're not going to have significant weight gain or other side effects in that time period, even though they might look kind of weight neutral in a half a year or a year later, someone could gain substantial amounts of weight. So I think sometimes you have to be mindful of what to do. But in the short run, stopping that mania and getting someone to sleep is very important. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think sometimes we'll go for like more sedating medications mm-hmm. on the inpatient unit. And then outpatient wise, they may not be able to tolerate that long run, but it would be nice to continue the same one for long run. The bipolar depression medicines are capable of treating depression without setting off a manic episode. And I think you were saying that a lot of pediatricians are afraid of that. Mm-hmm. So I think symptoms that might lead you to think that someone might be bipolar would be rapid onset of depressive symptoms, any psychotic symptoms, like psychotic depression. So some people might have psychotic symptoms either at the top of their moods or at the bottom of their moods. So if you have like these mood congruent So major depression with psychotic features. So people tell like voices saying, oh, you're worthless, or I'm never going to be good at anything, or, you know, just kind of mood congruent psychosis. That would be a hint that this person could be bipolar. And then also having a lot of family history with the bipolar. So those three things might make you a little more cautious.
Are there particular medication adherence challenges with people who are bipolar?
Yes. So I think people who are manic feel great and they don't think they ever need to be on medicine and they don't want to be on medicine. And so a lot of times they'll stop their medication for that reason. I think for kids, we don't like to use medications that have a lot of side effects in general, but some of the specific challenges with like lithium would be acne or weight gain. Anything that causes weight gain is a problem for adolescent females and males sometimes. And so, yes, there are some adherence problems. And then there's, you know, I think it's hesitancy on doctors' parts and families' parts because of these side effects associated with some of these medications. And so I think that leads to possibly some delayed diagnosis, but also more careful diagnosis that people want to make sure that we're kind of treating the right thing.
Which features are most likely to require inpatient treatment? What patients need to be hospitalized?
So anybody that looks like they're manic needs to be hospitalized, unless for some reason you can get parents to stay with their kid 24/7 and you want to prescribe the antipsychotic yourself. But you probably need some assistance from the call-up line if you were wanting to do something like that. Suicidality and self-harm are also, you know, reasons to hospitalize as well.
I'm guessing that treatment with medication, because of the kinds of medications involved, can be relatively difficult to balance. Is that your impression?
Yes, I think so. There have been some studies for Depakote for mood stabilization and for kids with bipolar, but for females, we worried about polycystic ovarian. We worry about getting blood draws. I think blood draws are generally a challenge for kids. So, you know, it makes Depakote difficult, lithium difficult. And then with the second generation antipsychotics, we're even wanting to get some blood for the metabolic problems it can cause.
What other therapeutic interventions are helpful for bipolar disorder?
There have been some psychotherapies studied for bipolar disorder. So there's functional family therapy, which focuses on increasing communication with kids and their families. There's also multifamily educational groups. And then there's this rainbow therapy, which is a combination of cognitive behavioral therapy and some family therapy. But a lot of these therapies, when they're used, people can decrease their length of time to remission. And also it decreases the severity of future mood episodes. Many of these family therapies focus on kind of empathic validation. So the kids aren't to be blamed for their symptoms. Mm-hmm. So they're a little bit more positive. And then they've also focused on relapse prevention. So how to, you know, take care of themselves. Stuff like managing your stress so you don't have to pull an all-nighter, or making sure you sleep well, or even for maintaining sleep. Like if you have a long distance trip, you have to take increased coping skills, increasing knowledge of mood symptoms. I think for some parents, they focus on working together to manage symptoms and take responsibility for choices that the kids can make for themselves. Some parents are like, well, you're just giving them an excuse for, you know, not doing this. And I say, no, well, because you have this, you have to try harder to manage these things. And so I think the family therapy has been good. It also helps parents be better consumers for mental health. And so they will advocate for their kid better in their schools and also with their healthcare providers. But there's definitely some focus on sleep hygiene, medication compliance, monitoring for risks of substance abuse.
So sleep hygiene, I'm personally convinced that better sleep hygiene fixes almost everything. But I think you mentioned last week that poor sleep can trigger a manic episode.
Yes, poor sleep can definitely trigger manic episode.
So what advice do you give your patients about what they ought to be doing in terms of sleep?
They should do a little bit of homework every day so they don't have to do all-nighters. They should try to be very regular about sleep. I actually tell them they should be very regular about everything. They should be regular about their eating. They should be regular about exercise. They should try to get up at a certain amount of time a day, because then they will naturally follow, you know, get tired about 14 to 15 hours later. And I also say you should be regular about your social interactions. You know, like, depression will cause someone to want to socially isolate, and then they get more depressed. So you have to treat it like homework and keep going out and doing things, you know, keep exercising, keep socializing, even if you don't feel like it. It's like going to the gym. Like, you go to the gym, even if you don't feel like it, to help maintain your mood. But sleep is very important. So important that I actually offer, for my adult patients, I'll offer some sedative hypnotics, even if they have to take like a trip to Europe or New Zealand. And for kids, sometimes I'll offer parents small doses of antipsychotic medications in case their kid has to have sleep maintained for those trips, or trazodone or melatonin. I'll even suggest melatonin. But sleep is like medicine. We cannot stabilize mood unless we get someone to sleep. It's very important. I'd rather over-sedate someone for a few days to treat the mania than to have that go on.
And that's probably true in most of the diseases you treat, that better sleep. You mentioned 2 weeks ago that the diseases you treat always imply some amount of dysfunction. And better sleep, it seems, makes our brain better capable of functioning in a predictable and reliable way.
Exactly. Yes. You know, some of my patients have, for lack of a better word, meltdowns, you know, after a certain time every night. But when they go to sleep, their brain just resets and they do better the next day. And so sometimes that happens. I think it's very important to sleep so that your brain can rest.
So you mentioned potentially using melatonin, or I don't know how you feel about diphenhydramine for occasional use. Are there any other over-the-counter medications that you think are helpful in treating bipolar disorder, or herbal remedies?
I'm not sure I've encountered over-the-counter medications. I think possibly maybe omega-3 fatty acids or fish oil for the depressive side. I think for winter depression or seasonal depression, which a lot of patients with bipolar disorder have, I would consider light therapy or phototherapy. Mm-hmm. So people can get those phototherapy lights, the 10,000 lux lights. Mm-hmm. We usually recommend people sit 12 to 18 inches from the light. They don't have to be looking at the light, but the light has to be shining at them. And we usually recommend that in the first half of the day or in the morning, generally. For some people who are bipolar, the light can actually set off a little bit of a manic or mood episode. So I tell my patients that if you feel yourself getting revved up, then you should probably cut down on the time of the light or stop using the light. But I also think outside time, even during the winter, is great. I say people can go on walks and don't use sunglasses. They should get that bright sunlight into their eyes. So I think that can help.
In closing, I wanted to just talk about some things that could be confused for bipolar disorder. Are there other psychiatric diagnoses that can look like bipolar disorder?
As far as psychiatric, I think that substance-induced mood disorder is always high up there. So it's important to try to make sure you get a urine drug screen. So if someone's on cocaine or a stimulant, for schizoaffective disorder, that's like a combination of bipolar disorder plus schizophrenia. So the difference would be schizoaffective people tend to have psychosis. So they have the moodiness of bipolar disorder, but they also have psychotic features kind of when people are euthymic or in the middle. Whereas with bipolar disorder with psychotic features, they only have the psychosis at the top or the bottom of their mood, at the mood extremes. So that could look like bipolar disorder. And then there are probably some medical conditions. I think some seizure disorders with certain, you know, focuses or foci.
Epilepsy or something like that.
Yes. Yes. I think that can sometimes set off a mood episode or look like a mood episode, because some people get aggressive. And then, you know, thyroid condition, possibly steroids can set off a mood episode. So I've had people put on prednisone who become manic, and some of my patients, we actually give them as needed olanzapine for that. And there are probably some other neurological conditions that are more
like infectious things or oncologic things. The thing is that brains are complicated. And so I guess it's always important to keep an open mind, but it seems that bipolar disorder is a little less mysterious to me now than it was a couple of weeks ago. It's been very helpful.
Thank you.
So for one thing, if people have questions about their patients, they can always reach you through the call-up line. And again, to leave questions on the call-up line, you can go to uofuhealth.org/call-up, and we'll put that in the slow notes. That's call-up. And the phone number, and you guys are available Monday through Friday, 12:30 to 4:30, is that correct?
I think it's 12 to 4:30.
12 to 4:30. Well, see, I just gave you a half hour to catch up. First of the shift. And the number there is 801-587-3636. And this is really a wonderful program funded by the legislature. Thanks, legislature. And it's important that we use this because it really is a great resource. And for troublesome things like this, I have found that it's been very helpful. If there's a patient that I'm having a hard time sorting out, that folks at the call-up line have been very, very helpful.
And we're happy to help you guys.
Yeah. And if you have questions about our topic over the last couple of weeks, please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com. If you'd like to claim credit, please go to the website. And beyond that, please tell your friends and neighbors to listen to our podcast and rate it and say nice things. And if you have criticisms, just email me. I'm happy to respond. Dr. Lynn, thanks for spending time with us the last couple of weeks. We look forward to talking to you again sometime in the future.
Thank you, Dr. Orcus.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.